for better or for worse, I kind of, my experience in online travel was during September the 11th, and my experience in online real estate was in 2008 in the global financial crisis, which were sort of awful at the time. But that change created the opportunity, and that's exactly the opportunity to strike.
Welcome to Two Sided, the Marketplace Podcast, brought to you by ShareTribe.
Hello and welcome. I am Stuart, CMO at ShareTribe, and I am your host. Welcome to the second last episode, but the last episode with a guest of this season of Two Sided. We're definitely closing the guest list with a bang, just the way we started. I am joined today by Pete Flint, co-founder and partner at NFX, one of the leading venture firms specializing in network effects. But before being an investor, Pete was also a founder and an operator. He was part of the founding team at LastMinute.com, which was acquired in 2005 for $1.1 billion. And Pete was also the CEO and co-founder of Trulia, which he took public in 2012 at the New York Stock Exchange and was later acquired by Zillow. So Pete has truly seen it all. At NFX, Pete and his team have a unique perspective, I think, on how network effects drive defensibility in marketplaces. And maybe defensibility is immediately already one of the main points in this conversation. Pete explains why network effects are the best form of defensibility of marketplace businesses and how they make companies resilient over time. We'll also talk a lot about AI's role in marketplaces. This is something that NFX is very focused on right now. And Pete discusses how AI, they think, is both disrupting and enabling marketplaces, and also why it's creating entirely new marketplace models. And finally, Pete shares from his experience some great advice for marketplace founders, from identifying the hardest side of a marketplace to seizing opportunities during economic downtimes or regulatory change. So another terrific episode. I can't wait for you to dive in. But before we do that, a quick service announcement. So in 1 or 2 weeks, I'll be back with the very last episode, which will be another season summary episode, where I'll try to extract the key themes and learnings of this special season, as well as try to summarize how investors are looking at marketplaces right now. And of course, for you, try to find out the most important advice that they give to founders and aspiring founders. Also, I've gotten some very nice reactions over LinkedIn and email. I'd love to get more, so I'd love to hear what you think, and especially what you think was the most important lesson so far this season. You can leave it as a comment, or even better, just reach out to me on LinkedIn and let me know. You can find my name in the show notes. I won't bother to spell it here, but just add me on LinkedIn with a connection request and just leave your feedback. That is all. So as said, I'll be back soon with the Too Long Didn't Read version of this season. But for now, please enjoy my conversation with Pete Flint of NFX. Hi, Pete. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Yeah, really, I'm very happy you took the time to make it. I've been following NFX for a super long time and all the work that NFX has done around marketplaces, network effects, etc. But before we go very deep down the NFX and marketplace rabbit hole, could you tell us a little bit about what did you do before you became a marketplace investor?
Sure. So I guess I've been involved in marketplaces for, oh gosh, several decades now. So I guess I've had sort of three jobs. So the first was part of the founding team at LastMinute.com, which is a big Web 1.0 European travel marketplace. Mm-hmm. And so that was just an epic experience in building a marketplace business. And then in 2003, I moved to the US to originally attend graduate school at Stanford and then started Trulia while I was there. Mm-hmm. And Trulia is a big online real estate marketplace. And we ultimately went public and then merged with Zillow. And then I teamed up with James and Gigi, who also had a passion for network effects and mm-hmm. all things defensibility. And we started NFX. So, you know, there's sort of this magic around network effects that once you kind of like get the bug, you just want to do everything network effects.
Yeah, no, that is true. I've talked to several investors now. And for example, like Jose Moren, who's also been a marketplace entrepreneur. And we see it also, you know, like the company that produces this podcast, ShareTribe, we make marketplace software for founders, and we see people coming back, you know, idea one, and then it's like, well, you know, and then I went here and I saw another marketplace model in the making, so let's try this. Now I can relate. So NFX, probably the most network effects specialized fund that there is. Is there a typical NFX investment type that you look for? Like, are there specific areas that you look for?
Yeah, I'd say we are a stage-specific, sector-agnostic firm. So like what we love to do as a firm is just to be the early, you know, often the first institutional investor with a company. You know, we're all founders and operators, and so we've been in the founder's shoes at this sort of really ambiguous time at the beginning. You know, but in term, and what we look for is, you know, companies that will be around in 10, 20, 30, 50 years time because they have this inherent defensibility. The defensibility, the best form of defensibility we've seen is through network effects. It's the most efficient, it's the most defensible. You know, businesses that have this property just become super resilient. And, you know, I think when you think of network effects, you think marketplaces, and we're super active in that space. But we also just think about network effects in many different constructs. So whether that's bio platforms, Omri leads our bio practice, and so we do a lot in longevity. And so they may not start with a network effect, but they build in network effects over time. There's a bunch of AI SaaS companies that we back, which, you know, may not be obvious network effects at the beginning, but we know that they've got this really incredible V1 product that gets a lot of traction. And to stop the myriad of competitors coming off of them and eroding margins and adding more competition, then they need to add that network effect over time. So we love network effects at the beginning. It's often that they add them later. But we, you know, we always have a thesis around what is the defensibility, what's the network effect for the company.
Yeah, that's actually interesting. And maybe like the AI, is it possible to talk about the AI SaaS one as an example? Because often like the picture to the outside is like, oh, well, they had some traction and that is what the investor looks for. And then obviously this is a thing. And now you're basically saying that, well, there is a V1, there might not be network effects here. We expect them to do, like, how do you evaluate an opportunity? And sort of the non-obvious one that you mentioned is maybe a really nice one to sort of go through that state, like through that evaluation.
Sure. I think, you know, it's, look, every company is different, but I think the stuff that, you know, we would look for is, you know, what is the market size? How defensible is the either insight or the capability they've built? For instance, like, you know, you'd see a bunch of companies that are building AI tools off public data. And that may be a great way to start because they're kind of pulling all this public data in and they can make sense of that. But, you know, unless they add more proprietary data over time, whether that's customer submissions or whether that's something else, then it's going to be hard for them to have real defensibility. You know, we look for kind of willingness to pay. You know, I think there's a lot of momentum right now in, you know, so an example would be that there are certain AI tools that are substituted labor and where you've got kind of a labor constrained environment or kind of labor quality problem, then you're seeing a lot of velocity in those areas as well. So those are a couple of things. You know, you could sort of perceive investors to be sort of, you know, sort of singularly focused on kind of like one or two things. You know, if I was to kind of where investors are probably, and this is generalization, where there's companies that see a lot of interest is where you see very rapid traction and very rapid growth, simply because investors are really struggling to predict the future. And so it could be a company that's in a really crowded space, really mediocre retention, tons of competition, unclear about market size, but if they are growing really quickly, then investors are like, well, we don't really kind of know what the future is going to hold, but we know this company is able to scale really, really quickly. So we're going to take out a bet on it. And that, you know, because they know there's going to be category leaders, which we anoint in this AI phase, just like you see category leaders anointed in the mobile phase and the web 1.0 phase.
Yeah.
And so investors are really backing up the truck to those companies.
Yeah, because I think the AI criticism that I hear a lot is that there is no moat, right? Like there is, because it's all like, they're all LLMs and, but if I understand you right, you're saying that, well, there is maybe initially not, but just speaking in very general terms, like as over time, more and more custom data maybe gets put into the model, it becomes defensible, right? Is that what you're saying? Am I understanding it right?
Yeah, I think that's a key part of it for sure. I mean, there's obviously within AI, there's sort of different levels from chips to models to infra to apps. We're really focused on the app layer, which we think there's going to be hundreds, if not thousands, of really significant companies. I think the I mean, where defensibility comes from, absolutely, is product experience driven by proprietary data or network effects. Very much a kind of embedding or a stickiness of these services, just in the same way that the companies that first installed Salesforce are in. Everyone's trained on it. Everyone's using it. The data's there. And
yeah,
sure, they could switch to something cheaper or, you know, with equivalent functionality, but it's, they're there and they're embedded. And so the workflow is meaningful because if you're a tax accountant or a lawyer, like, you go through the change management of installing this piece of mm-hmm. software and it's yep. pretty good, you're not going to rip it out in 3 years. And then I think there is going to be this virtuous cycle of the more successful companies have more customers and they're able to invest in product experience and marketing and scale and data mm-hmm. and features and the ecosystem around it, that there is very much going to be sort of defensibility around that in terms of brand adoption. You know, some of this stuff is sensitive, and if you're replicating kind of, you know, human processes or dealing mm-hmm. with proprietary data, you don't want to just, like, you know, use any off the shelf, you know, the cheapest open source thing that you can yeah. find. There will be a ton of defensibility around these businesses.
Yeah, that makes sense. If I can ask about this, because this just came out, but actually, remember if you were one of the writers, but NFX just put out this new piece about AI agents. Could you tell a little bit about that, especially in the relation to marketplaces?
Yeah, my colleague just put it out. I've not had a chance to read it. I'm happy to kind of like how we think about.
So talking about AI, so now we talked about AI businesses who sort of center around AI. There's also been a lot of talk about how AI will change existing marketplaces or add on to existing marketplace model. Like, what's your view on that?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, AI is both going to be a disruptor to certain marketplaces, and it's also going to be an enabler of other marketplaces. And then it's going to create entirely new marketplaces that we haven't really kind of envisaged to date. So, I mean, the disruption will happen where you have somewhat digital commodity services. So you could think of companies like Fiverr mm-hmm. one extent. And while they're probably pushing back on the disruption, it's sort of this inevitable, there's a degree of disruption in the area, or coding marketplaces mm-hmm. like Upwork. And so, you know, where really the AI substitutes the human in that regard. And then you've got, you know, perhaps the other extreme is like, you know, here in San Francisco, Lyft, which is the kind of number two behind Uber in mm-hmm. terms of rideshare marketplaces, now has equivalent yep. market share to Waymo. And, you know, Waymo is, you know, is part robotics, part AI, but it clearly wouldn't exist without AI. And so it's like, that's very disruptive to portions of that marketplace. Not perhaps not everything, but like portions of that marketplace. So that's where there's disruption at. There's another piece, which is enablement, which is, look, when you think about the kind of marketplaces themselves, you've got supply acquisition, you've got matching, and you've got demand acquisition and retention.
Yeah.
And you can see how AI can do incremental or significant impact to kind of to each of those kind of three areas. So, you know, you can sort of either sort of create synthetic supply mm-hmm. or you can engage supply more effectively, or build AI SaaS tools that kind of, you know, create the tools that kind of keep supply engaged. You can create, you know, highly personalized matching experiences.
Yeah.
You can create, you know, similarly demand engagement and acquisition as well. So you've got, you should be able to kind of deepen liquidity. So the incumbents with existing network effects, you know, should in many situations see AI as an accelerant to the business. And then finally, you've got, you know, AI, which is going to be create entirely new marketplaces. And so it's, you know, we'll see kind of where that goes. But like, you know, Hugging Face is essentially a marketplace of models. You can see agent to agent communication. There's going to be, you know, platforms that facilitate kind of privacy and authentication across different services. And so that's going to be entirely new companies are going to be created out of this.
Yeah. When you say those things, it makes me glad I'm not an investor, because I find it really hard to sort of imagine. I would be an investor because you said there's trouble envisioning the future, because that is, you know, like the marketplaces, the AI marketplaces we haven't thought up yet. I find that really hard to just envision, like to see where this would be going.
There's certain markets which have historically been just sort of off limits because of their complexity or because of a degree of kind of market adoption. So, and I think if you look at, if you speak to any CIO now, they're like, their board is demanding what their AI strategy is.
Yeah.
So the CIOs are like, okay, we, you know, previously we used pen and paper to something or spreadsheets, and now we're like, okay, we're using AI to do things. So you've got this Trump's world right now, but like government procurement and government processes, it's like most sane founders would avoid that, but you have the combination of AI plus a kind of regulatory environment where it's like, oh, this is game on. And there's a bunch of those industries which, you know, they should have digital platforms there, and AI will create this sort of momentum in those sectors that we haven't seen before. And that's for sure going to happen.
Yeah, I think that that is like, I think that's the case. I can still sort of imagine, especially like a few of the investors I talked to have a sort of a B2B focus where you have indeed like these sort of very complex procurement processes, which are, you know, that always have had some kind of human interface to just get all the information in the right order or to ask the right question. And I can definitely see that sort of empowerment or even maybe even a completely new model of doing those things through some AI agent, if that is the right term. I can see that, but some of the, you know, AI marketplaces that are, well, that are creating data that wasn't there before and somehow make that usable. But yeah, speaking of things that are coming, if we leave the AI on the side for a moment, I'm wary of using the term trends, but do you see in the portfolio or in recent slide decks that are being sent to you, do you see some other interesting developments in marketplaces or two-sided platforms or network effects businesses?
The AI thing is prevalent in really every kind of software company that's starting over the last couple of years right now, and even the scale one. So I think it is a really big story for every incumbent or new marketplace. You know, I think there is, you know, you've seen this perhaps evolution of marketplaces to go from pure marketplaces, vertical marketplaces to fintech-enabled marketplaces. So the sort of fintech component is very much there. And then adding the kind of services component on top of that, in terms of sort of agentic experiences to kind of create these more kind of full stack marketplaces, very much there. And we're seeing a lot of marketplaces that are really coming up through this SaaS tool approach.
Yeah.
They're kind of building, they're solving a sort of a niche problem, which is interesting and enough to get sort of traction. And then that creates a kind of a wedge tool that can create an entirely new marketplaces. So my partner, James, wrote a piece, gosh, maybe a decade ago, which was called Market Networks, which was really the identification that there's, you know, significant value to be created, particularly on the B2B side, where you've got market networks, which really combine great workflow. So typical SaaS tool. Combined with a marketplace where you can participate in transactions and, you know, add incremental revenue and utility, and then an identity layer. So how do you make it a multiplayer experience? And you actually see these sort of components in various different weightings across like so many SaaS tools right now. That sort of identity layer is sort of prevalent in so many things that are kind of happening right now. And I think the marketplace perhaps started off as a sort of transactional marketplace. And I think it's going to get, that won't just be like, okay, where can I find suppliers or where can I purchase goods? But I think you'll start to see where can I get services? Where are the agentic services I can get? And so if you're in a finance space, okay, like how do I get, rather than introduce me to an accountant, okay, who's going to file my taxes or through a kind of AI agentic experience. And so there's a sort of high degree of complexity around this, which may be intimidating for some startups, but the cost of building software has gone down so quickly that you're seeing small startups build, you know, these fully functioning experiences with agentic type tools or services or marketplaces and, you know, a high usability kind of workflow solution. And identity layer wrapped in. And you can see how this, once this thing kind of gets established, you're like, whoa, there's so much defensibility, you know, and also virality within the organization and internally and potentially externally, that you can see a lot of adoption defensibility.
Does that also, so that changes, you know, like you mentioned now that like bringing these things together, change all the things like individually. Do you see those changes also if you think, for example, about like revenue models, you know, like coming back to what you said earlier, like there used to be a demand, supply, transaction, and then, you know, the monetization happened on the transaction side. Now, of course, with all these added services, like, are you seeing any new developments in that part? So the revenue collection or the business model?
I think marketplaces that are purely providing matching are generally insufficient to provide enough kind of utility. Because matching is sort of a discovery problem. You know, I'd say the big opportunities that have been kind of built over the last 20 years have already been taken, many of them, for simple matching. But it's actually a lot of the other, whether that's trust and safety, whether that is tools on the supply side to keep them deeply engaged, tools on the demand side to kind of really provide personalized experiences. And so, simple matching kind of in the vein of kind of eBay is sort of, eroded in these kind of like highly focused and great experiences and vertical solutions. It doesn't mean your business model can only be transactions, but I think there's entrepreneurs are seeing tons of other opportunities, and the SaaS business model itself is, an incredible business model as well. And so we're seeing a lot of SaaS-enabled marketplaces naturally.
Yeah.
And that's been a case for many years. Obviously, a lot of secondary revenue streams in the form of fintech, where companies are providing, whether that's payments or financing experiences on top of that. And then, the agentic business model is really the sort of pay for the outcome or pay for the work, which is transactional related, but it's the margins on those businesses can be very significant. And you could debate whether they're, they're marketplaces themselves, but really there's a ton of money to be made for startups which are providing. There are labor components that would be traditionally done associated with a transaction. By automating that process, the marketplace isn't able to tap into that particular transaction.
Yeah. Could you maybe give an example of that? Like when you say like an agentic workflow, like do you have a real world example, like from maybe from the portfolio or from a better known example?
I mean, just taking some ideas from the real estate space. And so you can see in, real estate transactions that you see, there's a transaction coordination piece, which is kind of managing the documents and getting everyone online, which is via outsourced to a human, that would be thousands of dollars. We can also see a case in kind of architecture where similar kind of like perhaps consulting or kind of permitting process would be replaced by agents who would provide a bunch of those services. And if those are kind of components to an existing marketplace, we kind of often see there's sort of two modes. One is that they discount back to the consumer or the user, where they say, okay, we're going to offer this product or service at a much cheaper price. And that's, disruptive experience. Or the other approach is like, okay, we're going to keep the margin and then triple down on sales and marketing or other product experience areas. And often depends on the willingness to pay. There are many, and I think a lot of these sort of traditional functions which were done by humans is actually quite high willingness to pay because, less commoditized, they're more complex. And so people are willing to pay. And so, the margins on some of these AI, add-ons to marketplaces or pure AI companies can be really significant. It's, it could debate how defensible they are, but I think if they're associated with a highly defensible marketplace, they're going to be pretty defensible.
Yeah, you mean like defensible as in like over time, of course, their value will diminish, right? Like as they become
Correct.
The new table stakes to the market. Maybe speaking about like over time, like you mentioned you've been in marketplaces over some decade. The audience of this podcast is a lot like aspiring marketplace founders, early stage marketplace founders. Are there still some things that you feel like that you learned, for example, in your experience that you see and that you regularly find yourself like advising founders? Like this is actually like in a two-sided platform, this is what you should do, or this is what you absolutely should not do.
There's a bunch of different things. I think number one is like find what is the really hard side of the marketplace and figure out how to solve that first. Usually it's like, sure, supply and demand are hard, but one side is particularly hard. And focusing in on like how you can solve that side of the marketplace first is going to be critical. There's a lot of marketplace founders which I think are not really attuned to the kind of like the level of sort of fragmentation within a category. And fragmentation can be like super scary, but it's necessary to kind of to build a really compelling marketplace. And so, you see that just it's sort of supply side homogeneity. So like you look at, Airbnb versus Uber. And so looking for that fragmentation is really critical. And then often finding a really clever hack to aggregate supply and or demand. And there's, and I think there's always a hack, whether that's like companies were building in the mobile era that they could attract supply and demand or demand in a unique way.
Yeah.
Whether that was sort of the Facebook social network era, how can you kind of attract supply and demand in a clever, cost-effective way?
Yeah.
And then AI creates like such a myriad of solutions. So it's quite possible that there are marketplaces that just don't exist today because it's been too hard to get liquidity to aggregate the supply and demand. But if you can identify ways to aggregate using some new technology or some new economic trend, then that can be super critical. Perhaps the last thing is like, you know, I sort of, for better or for worse, I kind of, my experience in online travel was during September the 11th, and my experience in online real estate was in 2008 in the global financial crisis, which were sort of awful at the time. But that change created the opportunity, because if you take a step back, what do marketplaces do? They connect supply and demand. Where you have a mismatch in supply and demand through, you know, because of some sort of economic change or sort of some environmental or regulatory change, then that absolutely creates an opportunity for marketplaces to provide much more utility over the incumbents. You can see folks moving over from perhaps an incumbent marketplace to a new marketplace, if they're able to really navigate some of this economic or cultural change. You know, some founders, they're faced with a sea change in their market, and that's exactly the opportunity to strike. And often those sea changes are kind of are in periods of distress in a market. And you may think you're kind of like the market opportunity is much less interesting today, but that's exactly the time that you should be moving forward, moving quickly, trying to gain market share when there's all this like volatility going on, and the incumbents are typically, you know, just unable to react with the speed, the new demands on the supply and demand side.
All right. Hey, I think that's a great way to end this podcast. Thanks a lot for your time, Pete. Where can people check out Pete and or NFX?
Thanks. It was great chatting. So NFX.com is our website. You can find more info about me, the team, and then sign up for an email newsletter that's packed full of kind of advice for aspiring and existing entrepreneurs.
All right. Thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Two Sided, the Marketplace podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe. And if you really liked it, please give us a rating or a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. If you got inspired to build your own marketplace, go visit www.sharetribe.com. It's the fastest way to build a successful online marketplace business.